Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Bonnie Kay and the Straight Wives Talk Show, a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexity of marriages between straight women to gay men. Each week, my co-hostess Misty Hall and I discuss the issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay or bisexual man. So thank you for joining us, and good evening, Misty. How are you?
I'm doing good, Bonnie. Good evening to you as well. How are you?
I'm doing good here in Philadelphia. The weather is beautiful, in the 60s, the way I like it. How about with you in Kentucky?
It is beautiful. All my my trees are in bloom. Of course, my allergies are too, but everything is beautiful. It was a perfect day today. Today was perfect.
I'm so glad. Spring is finally here. Mm-hmm. We just want to let our callers know, that our listeners know, that if you would like to call in to make a comment or to join our conversation or to talk to any of our guests, please get a pencil and I will give you the number to call. It is area code 646-716-4893. And I'll repeat that for you. Area code 646-716-4893. And we welcome any of your calls. Tonight we're going to be talking about a topic that's a difficult topic at best to talk about, but it's one that we really need to discuss. And we're going to be talking tonight about women who grow up in abusive situations with their families and how that impacts their relationships later on when they get married. And I think that all leads back to the whole subject of repeated cycles and as far as role modeling as you're growing up. And actually, Misty, I was out with several friends today at lunchtime, and we were having this conversation that a lot of times when we go into relationships that are the wrong relationships for us, that men are very able to find women who are very vulnerable. You know, they know how to seek them out. And if they've grown up in a relationship where the father has been the dominating presence and he hasn't been very kind to his wife, that's the kind of woman that they're going to look for when they're ready to get married. Have you found that to be true?
Absolutely. Almost always you can, when you look at a relationship, and, you know, my background is in marriage and family therapy, so that's what we studied during the whole master's program is relationships. And it's so interesting, when you dissect a relationship, you oftentimes find patterns. You oftentimes find patterns that you repeat that possibly your parents taught you, which is really interesting. And sometimes you do this without even knowing. And it's always really interesting and very enlightening when you sit down with the client and discuss, you know, with them, you know, where did you learn about love? Where did you learn about relationships? What type of relationship did your parents have, your grandparents, aunts, uncles, you know, things like that? And it's really interesting how that we pick up on that.
Well, it's funny because, I was just going to say, the one friend that I had, one of the two friends that I was with, she just got out of a relationship with a guy who wasn't particularly nice to her. And she was with him for about 2 years. And, of course, the first thing she said to me is, well, we didn't fight at all. I said, well, I guess you didn't. I said, because you went along with everything he said, because he's very controlling. And she said, that's a really good point. And I said to her, let me ask you this question. What kind of relationships, you know, did your mother have? And she said, my mother, continued to be in very abusive types of relationships where men would really physically abuse her, emotionally abuse her, and she continued to stay in them. So I just thought, you know, that's the way it's supposed to be. And that's the kind of relationships that, you know, she's had. She's in her 40s now. But it's just a continuing pattern that, you know, she learns to accept it. And she is the nicest woman you could ever ask for. And she's attractive and she's smart. And yet she just feels that she has to accept this. Well, she's starting to feel differently now because I'm really working on her.
Good.
And I think that, you know, where I put it in perspective for her, and I think that all of our women really have to try to go outside their body for the moment. And I continually say this because it's so important that if you have a daughter or you have a sister or you have a best friend and you would see them in your relationship, would you tell them it's okay? Would you think, oh, that's a good match for somebody I love? And if it's not, then you shouldn't expect anything else, you know, less for yourself. You know, you'll have to expect just as much for yourself as you would for someone you love. But I think it goes back to the whole thing of role modeling and leaving a legacy behind. You know, this is the way that women are socialized, that they think that they should stay in these types of relationships because their mother stayed in a relationship. And that's why I think the whole issue of staying together for the sake of the children is such a dangerous situation. Where when women say to me, well, you know, we have children, we have to stay together for their sake. I don't think that's setting, you know, any kind of good example for them. What do you think, Misty?
Oh, I agree with you, Bonnie. There's actually, if they want to get into the nitty-gritty of it, there's a lot of research out there. I mean, go to any major university and search their library, and you're going to find lots of research how that if you stay in the relationship for the children and there's a lot of conflict in the home, there's research that shows that it's worse on the child than the breakup in the marriage. So I have to agree with you. I think you don't stay for the sake of the children. I think you need to, you know, figure out your situation, and if the conflict is high, and especially in a straight gay marriage, you know, there's so many issues, you have to really evaluate that and ask yourself, what am I teaching my children? Because you're teaching your children about relationships, whether you're doing it in a good way or a bad way.
Exactly.
So, you know, ask yourself that, you know, get curious and say, you know, what, like you just said, you know, you can just throw, and I oftentimes find with my clients that they say, well, you know, I'm not for sure if my husband is gay. What if he's not gay? And then I say, okay, well, look at the rest of your relationship. Just throw that out. You know, what in this relationship is good or bad? What's the deal breaker? What, you know, what is broken that you can't fix? So there's lots of things. And I think we learn these patterns way back, way back. Our families teach us to, you know, put up with certain things. And, you know, for myself, when I reflect back on what my parents taught me, and actually mine's a little different. My parents, they're still married today, and they had a very good relationship. So I come at it from a little bit different perspective, but I know they taught me certain things, you know, to be accepting of people, and I think I carried that too far in terms of, not that I wouldn't accept people for being gay, but, you know, when you're married to a gay husband and that wasn't what you planned on doing, I think I just accepted too many things and thought I had to stay married because my parents, you know, remain married. And, you know, because they would have conflict like all marriages do, but they always worked it out. Of course, they never dealt with the same things I dealt with. So I learned from them that, you know, you just work through your issues and you stay together. Well, the gay-straight thing was just not a issue that I was going to be able to work through. So,
right, that's not, you know, an issue that is workable. And not just people keep trying to push something together that can't fit.
Mm-hmm.
It just ends up that people are more frustrated, more angry, more depressed. And when I think about women, and I feel my heart goes out to the women who write to me every week on how they have to be on antidepressants to cope in their marriage. And that really hurts me, that you have to alter your mind in order to cope in a situation. I mean, there's something really wrong with that picture. And I tell this to women, if you have to take an antidepressant because of the fact that your marriage is so unhappy, then does that say something? And yet, you know, they feel that they have to keep trying, or they're afraid to leave, or they can't get out. Or, you know, they're making the wrong decision, or, you know, they have to show their husbands more support, give them another chance. You know, it's just so many, it's a myriad of excuses of why women, you know, stay in their marriages. And I always say that even if you can't be physically free at the moment, you have to first become emotionally free. If you can become emotionally free, then the next step will be physical freedom. I realize that every woman can't walk out the minute she, you know, finds out the news. But you have to start building up your, you know, emotional state so that you will be ready to leave and that you can walk out and you can be independent. Because I think we tend to become very codependent on, you know, these relationships. And as you call it, Misty, you know, you're dancing in the circle of crazy. After a while, that becomes your life and your reality. Isn't that true?
It's true. When you get inside, once it crosses that threshold to the point of dancing inside the circle of crazy, everything seems normal, and you just find yourself adapting to more and more and more. and it's just so difficult to make decisions. And I think the longer you dance inside that circle of crazy, I do believe the more codependent the relationship becomes and the more helpless the person gets, and it's just harder to get out.
I guess, you know, it kind of hurts me because of the fact that I feel that women have choices in this country, and in a lot of other countries they don't have choices. And I'm not saying it's an easy choice, and especially if you're financially dependent on someone. You know, I know that's really rough. And, you know, especially when you have children and you don't have the means of support. I know when I was in that situation, you know, I was very desperate also. And yet I felt that at least even if I had to be on my own and I had nothing, it was better than having to be in a situation where every day I was walking on eggshells, crying every night, crying myself to sleep. So it was really difficult for me in that sense. So it was easier as far as, you know, moving ahead when I had to finally make that decision. And I had two little babies, and I didn't have, you know, much of anything, and I didn't expect that people would, you know, necessarily make that same decision I did. But I never regretted it for a day. No matter how hard life was with two little babies and raising them, it was still easier than having to live with someone who I had to be, you know, snooping on every minute, wondering where he was, wondering who he was with, and feeling, you know, violated in my own home, you know, and feeling nauseous about it every day. That has to be the worst feeling. And that's why when women, you know, tell me that they're taking antidepressants to cope with this, and I think there's something definitely wrong. When you were growing up, I'm sure you didn't envision yourself getting married to somebody and then taking medication so you could pretend that the relationship was better than it was. I mean, I find that really, you know, there's something wrong with that whole picture. So I tell women, if you're in that situation where you have to take antidepressants to cope, you really need to examine, is this a situation, a healthy situation for me, for the children? I mean, children can sense when there is a problem in the marriage, correct?
Absolutely. There's studies. There's lots of research on that as well. They sense it. They pick it up. I don't care how well you think you're hiding it from your children. You know, there's infants can pick up stress in the home. They can be more fussy. They can, you know, cry more. So, I mean, these babies and children and toddlers, they pick this up. They truly do. Even if you think you've got it well hid, they pick up the stress levels in the home. I always say a child is a good barometer of what's going on in the home. Just look at them. Watch the reactions. How are they going? How are they doing? So it is difficult on children.
Yeah, it's funny. I had a gentleman send me an article this week, and I was really impressed with it. He's a reporter for the BBC in London. And he did a whole article, and it was really fascinating. If anybody's interested in reading it, please feel free to write to me at bondk@aol.com, and I'll be happy to send you a copy of it. And it's an article about life in China and about the gay community in China. And, you know, I was telling him that in this country, there's approximately, you know, 15% of gay married men, you know, or gay men who get married. And he was saying that in China, it's approximately 90%. You know, he did a lot of research on it. And when he was interviewing people, you know, they were very clear that, you know, because of the cultural expectations, there is no choice. You know, they have to get married. It's that simple. And so you're looking at millions of people, you know, when you think about it in China, that are getting into these marriages, that there's no way that they can have a fulfilling marriage because they're not going to be fulfilled and they can't fulfill their wife. And you look at the millions of women in that country who really have no choice. You know, that's the cultural expectation. You're going to get married and you're going to stay in that marriage. So that's why, you know, when I hear these sad stories and, you know, some people think, well, in China in the next 15, 20 years, that will change. But in a lot of these countries, they're not going to change. A lot of women just don't have a choice because of cultural differences. And in a few weeks, we're going to be having a show on cultural differences to discuss that more. But that's getting back to our topic for tonight, that if you have choices and you realize that there's something wrong in your marriage and you're taking medication, you know, it's time to really start thinking seriously about how do I get away from this. And I think a lot of it, once again, revolves around if you had an unstable family life yourself, then it's going to be very difficult to have a stable family life, and, you know, afterwards, unless you really work it through. And I think that we have seen, both of us, a lot of our women who came from abusive families where there was emotional abuse, and women who actually, you know, went into these marriages because it was the lesser of the two evils. At least somebody was treating them kindly or somebody was treating them nicely. You know, they weren't looking at all the other factors that were involved. So I think that, you know, you become very much, you know, a target for men who are looking for women who come from bad backgrounds, thinking that, you know, you'll be willing to accept anything. Anything is better than what you came from.
I find that happen a lot with the women I work with. It's so sad. So sad.
If anybody would like to call in and share their story, you can reach us here at area code 646-716-4893. And getting back to our topic of, you know, if you've been through abuse in your life, how you view your future relationships. And certainly I do know that, you know, if you've been abused when you were younger, that if you're abused when you're older, you just come to expect it. And I think that's why so many women hang in these marriages long past the time that they should be out of them, because it's just their expectation of watching what went on in their own home. And that's the sad part, that, you know, I see women who have given up their whole life being abused when they're younger, and now they go into a marriage and spend more years being manipulated and controlled. And, you know, I wanted to talk a little bit also about the mentality of many of the men who are involved in these relationships, and certainly not all of them. Because, you know, there are some good men who get married hoping things are going to work out. And, you know, they have no intentions of, you know, deceiving someone. You know, they're hoping against hope that when they get married, that those feelings that they have for other men are just going to disappear. And unfortunately, they don't, because, you know, gay feelings just don't go away. They only increase and enhance. But then there are other men who really have been living a lie, you know, their whole life. And, you know, they're not honorable men. Like, we were talking to a woman last week whose husband just married her because of the fact that he needed a cover, because he was in the military. And we did hear from some other military women this week, you know, who really appreciated that conversation because they're going through the same thing. And I did want to talk a little bit tonight also about the personality or the profile of a sociopath, because I think a lot of men become very sociopathic in their behavior. And I think it's important for women to recognize this so that you don't keep thinking that you're the crazy one. And I just wanted to talk about some of the common features of a sociopath, and maybe some of you will recognize this within your own husbands. And, you know, you have to recognize that you're not the one who's having the problem, that they are. So tell me if you know people like this. Missy, would you say your ex-husband was a sociopath?
Oh, he had many characteristics, that's for sure. And the interesting part was, in the beginning, I didn't notice these things. I think now looking back, of course, hindsight is always 20/20.
Mm-hmm.
Now looking back, you know, the more frustrated he became and the more he was trying to hide it, I think these things exacerbated even more.
Well, I'll read you a list and let me know how it affects, you know, if you feel that a lot of this was true in your own life. The first thing on the list is glibness and superficial charm. Was he charming to other people?
Yes. He was two different people. I lived with one person, and yet he was a different person to other people, absolutely.
And I hear that a lot from our women. They say, well, you know, everybody says you have the best husband, and you're so lucky, you know, because he's so much fun and he's such a great guy. And, you know, that's the husband that they're seeing, but that's not the husband that you're married to.
If I had a dollar every time I heard that, you know, for sure. Because they said, oh, you're so lucky, he helps you clean the house, he helps you, you know, do things around the house, he goes to the mall shopping with you and all these things. And, yeah, I mean, so the outside charm was great. It really was.
Yeah, and that's why I say they're able to really, you know, be very superficially charming.
Mm-hmm.
Another characteristic is manipulative and conning, that they never recognize the rights of others and see their self-serving behaviors as permissible. They appear to be charming, yet are covertly hostile and domineering. seeing the victim as merely an instrument to be used. They may dominate and humiliate their victims. And I see that a lot with our women. You know, these guys know how to push your buttons and to make you feel even more worthless than you already feel. And I see that a lot in the women that we're working with, that, you know, their husbands will unnecessarily criticize them. And, you know, as I was explaining to this one woman today that I was telling you about, is that, you know, these guys grew up with their, a lot of times with their own mothers being abused, and they saw how their fathers pushed all those buttons and how they were able to get their mothers to do whatever they wanted them to do. And so, you know, they've already had some training, and when they get into the relationships with us, it doesn't take much for them to, you know, hone in on where our weak spots are and to just go for it. Have you found that to be true?
Absolutely. My ex-husband knew exactly what to do, how to manipulate. It was even calculating and how to. He always had this great way of throwing it back on him of being the victim and me being the one committing the atrocity, whatever it would be for the day. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I became to believe it because he was really good at doing that. He was excellent at doing that.
And I think so many of these men are really excellent at doing that. You know, they make it like you're the one who's humiliating them when, in fact, you know, this is what they're doing. Another characteristic is they have a grandiose sense of themselves. They feel entitled to certain things as their right. And I think that a lot of times comes from their upbringing also, when they have fathers who are controlling and manipulative, and their mothers are always giving in. So that's the role modeling that they see. You know, they start to believe, well, this is the way it should be. So I think that's a very important characteristic also. The next one I think is particularly true of gay husbands. You know, good husbands or bad husbands. Either way, when you're a gay husband, this one is pathological lying, that he has no problem lying coolly and easily, and it's almost impossible for them to be truthful on a consistent basis. They can create and get caught up in a complete belief about their own powers and abilities, extremely convincing and even able to pass a lie detector test. And I think that when you live a lie every day of your life, that lying just becomes inherent in your nature, that you just start lying about anything. I mean, it doesn't even have to be anything important. But I think part of it is that you start lying to yourself, and I think we see that with a lot of our gay husbands, correct?
Absolutely. Once you just said it, I think you put it very well. Once you tell so many lies, and the worst crime is how they're lying to themselves,
mm-hmm.
you know, and not living their truth, hiding it like you're trying to hide it from themselves. And once you're so in depth into that, I just found that my ex would just tell me a lie about the strangest thing. You know, had he walked out to the mailbox and back? I mean, it was just. And it wasn't that I was looking for lies. It was never the stories added up. And it could be a simple story as, you know, like I said, mowing the lawn or going to the mailbox or pulling the garbage can back. I mean, it could be something very simple. I never
right,
knew
I think,
whether it was truth or fiction.
I think it just, like I say, becomes inherent in, you know, your personality. By the way, we do have a phone call coming in, so we'll take a pause for a moment. And if anybody else would like to call in, it's area code 646-716-4893. And just one moment. We'll welcome our caller. Hello.
Hi.
Can you
hear
us?
Hi, Bonnie. Hi, Misty. Yes, I can hear you.
Hi, who are you?
This is Teresa.
Hi, Teresa. How are you?
I'm fine.
Oh, thank you for calling us. Have you been listening at all?
Yes, it took me a few minutes to get onto the internet, so I was a little bit late coming in. But yes, I've been listening to your.
Yeah, we were just talking about sociopathic men, which
uh-huh.
I know I really feel that a lot of these gay husbands, you know, are sociopathic because they've been living a lie. You
right.
know, and I just want to go through a few more things, if you don't mind, Teresa, while we're on the subject.
Sure.
We're going down a list. Maybe some of this applied to your ex-husband, too. One of them is also a lack of remorse, shame, or guilt. That a deep-seated rage, which is split off and repressed, is at the core. They don't see others around them as people, but only as targets and opportunities. Instead of friends, they have victims and accomplices who end up as victims. The end always justifies the means, and they let nothing stand in their way. You know, they just don't really feel any sense of shame or, you know, sense of guilt. So I think that's very characteristic of some of these men, too. You know, they're out there cheating, bringing home diseases to their wives, and they don't feel guilty or they don't feel shameful. And the only time they actually feel bad is when they get caught. But before that, they don't seem to have any problem going out and doing this stuff. Do you find that to be true, Misty?
I found that to be true in my past life, being married to a gay husband. And, you know, but there was also so many dynamics in place. Not only was he gay, he was just so abusive. So with the domestic violence going on, yet all these are resonating with my particular situation.
Did he ever feel ashamed or guilty about what he was doing?
Did he?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no. When I would catch him up in something, and it would be like when the little lies didn't match up,
mm-hmm.
and I would just say something, and it was an explosion, and he would virtually attack me, verbally and physically. So I learned early on not to even question anything because he had no remorse. I mean, he would throw something at me one moment, and then the next day he would be fine. And matter of fact, he would say, you know, it's your fault we're not getting along. I'm trying to talk to you today, and you won't talk.
Yeah, it's your fault.
So, yeah, he was able, he had an uncanny ability to erase everything that had happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, put it back into my plate and say, you know, if we're going to get along today, it's going to be up to you because I'm trying to talk to you. So, you know, and it was always conditional. It was when he...
Teresa, did you have that issue with your ex-husband?
My husband, I'm listening to what Misty said. My husband was very, my gay husband was very explosive also.
Yeah,
he
a deep-seated rage. That's what it says.
Yeah, that pretty much describes it. It was severe enough that it would make me, I wouldn't even bring up the topic of intimacy or anything that he didn't want to talk about because he would just go into screaming rages.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. Looking back, I have to wonder why I put up with so much for so long.
Well, that brings us to, you know, what our topic was earlier. I'm sorry if you missed us in the beginning. And maybe you could give us some insight on that also. But I just want to finish this list, but we'll go back to that because
okay.
We were talking about growing up and your relationships at home. But going back to this list for sociopaths, shallow emotions, when they
mm-hmm.
show what seems to be warmth, joy, love, and compassion, it's more feigned than experienced and serves as an ulterior motive. Outraged by insignificant matters, yet remaining unmoved and cold by what would upset a normal person. Since they are not genuine, neither are their promises. So I guess that means, like, when they're promising you things will be different, that's not going to be happening. Another one is incapacity for love. You know, they live on the edge. Verbal outbursts and physical punishments are normal. Promiscuity and gambling are common. Does that affect either one of your ex-husbands?
He never mind this.
Go ahead, Misty, you go first.
Oh, okay. Yes and no. My ex, he did show, believe it or not, he did show love for his family. He really cared a lot about his parents and
mm-hmm.
some of his brothers and sisters. I really think he showed a true love for them. In terms of me and my family, he detested my family. But I think it was part of manipulation of isolating me to get me away from the family and my support network. So in that part, he did care for his, I think he genuinely loved his family. With now I didn't have any issues with him gambling that I knew of. I don't think he did any of that. So in terms of having shallow feelings.
Promiscuity?
Oh, wow. Yeah, absolutely. I was one of those women that would swear on her life that my ex-gay husband would have not cheated on me sexually. And going through the right before, I think it was right before I filed for divorce, I found so many things to where that, I mean, I've literally found his little black book, and it was full of his past dates and things of that nature. It was rather alarming. I was scared to death when I saw that. So I would have added, because we sort of made this pact. Of course, I didn't have any idea I was going to be dealing with a gay husband. But we made this pact early on. Both of our parents had remained married, so I felt pressure from that, you know. Both of our parents being married, and it was just divorce really wasn't much tolerating either side of the family. So anyway, you know, we sort of made this pact early on, you know, that we promised to be faithful to each other, and in the event that we were not, we would owe the respect to the other one to ask for a divorce.
Uh-huh.
And we actually had that early. We had that discussion early on, and I found out shortly before I filed for divorce that that was not true on his part. And I was one of those women that would have absolutely sworn on my life he would have not cheated on me sexually. And even though as angry and hostile as he could be towards me, that was something I didn't think he would do, but that's something he certainly did do.
How about you, Teresa, when it comes for incapacity for love with your ex-husband, living on the edge and promiscuity, verbal outbursts?
The gambling was one of the topics there. He didn't gamble, to my knowledge, with finances. Promiscuity, I would, now looking back, he definitely got out and about, but I didn't realize it at the time. I was just too naive to understand how he got his needs met. But
do you think he had the capacity for love or no?
He kept me at arm's distance. He always told me that he didn't trust anyone and he would never confide in anyone. He told me he didn't trust anyone and he would never trust me, that he wasn't close to anyone. He was close to one sister. He has a sister who's, 15 years older than him, and he has somewhat of a parent-child relationship with her.
Uh-huh.
So he was always very close to her, but he always told me that he would never be close to me.
How about this one?
And
callousness and lack of empathy. Unable to empathize with the pain of their victims, having only contempt for others' feelings of distress and readily taking advantage of them. Either one of you have a comment on that?
Lack of empathy. Absolutely. Like I said a little earlier, I think, when he would physically or verbally harm me, would always turn around to where it was my fault. He had no empathy to me, you know, empathy for me. It was, I made him do something. So, I mean, he was very callous in things such as that.
And what about yours, Teresa?
Things were always my fault, no matter what happened. It was always turned around to where... it was my fault, but he did have somewhat of a soft heart. My circumstance was a little bit, well, he had a soft heart, but then he had a mean spirit. So I don't know.
Well,
I think
that might tie to the next characteristic. It says poor behavioral controls and impulsive nature, that they have rage and abuse alternating with small expressions of love and approval. Produce an addictive cycle for the abuser and abused, as well as creating hopelessness in the victim. They believe they're all-powerful, all-knowing, entitled to every wish, no sense of personal boundaries, and no concern for their impact on others. So it shows that they go in cycles. You know, they kind of have small expressions of love and approval. So then you start thinking, okay, you know, this is getting better. And then, bam, it comes down on you again.
Mm-hmm. He definitely had severe mood swings, very severe mood swings.
Did either one of your husbands have problems in their, you know, early years of juvenile delinquency at all, or academic difficulties?
My ex, no. I would have to say no. I think he did well academically, and as far as I know, he was not in trouble with the law. There was a point in time when we were married, he kept getting speeding tickets one after another just because he would just he did not want to obey the speed limit at all. And, I mean, these would be traffic tickets severely over the speed limit, and he would just laugh about it. He always thought that was funny. So,
what about problems in making and keeping friends?
Yes, definitely.
Because that's another trait of the early behavior problems. And eventually they just have trouble keeping friends. How about yours, is Teresa?
Mine had, in high school he had friends, but then as an adult he always said that for men that the only friends they have are the ones they met in high school. He couldn't make adult friendships with men. He never felt like he fit in.
Mm-hmm.
With the activities that our son had, he didn't know how to mingle with the men often, or at church when they would have different kinds of men's activities, where maybe Saturday morning men's prayer breakfast,
mm-hmm.
he never felt like he belonged. He couldn't fit in to those kinds of social activities. He could with me, with my friends.
Mm-hmm.
If I went to a Tupperware party, he could go along for things like that and mingle well with the women, but he had a hard time socializing with men.
Here's another one that probably both of you can relate to. Irresponsibility and unreliability. It says, does not accept blame themselves, but blames others, even for acts they obviously committed. From what you're both telling me, that sounds pretty true, right?
For me, it is.
Mm-hmm, yes.
You know, rather than ever accept responsibility for anything they've done, it's just easier to blame everybody else for what the problem is.
Yeah, and a good example of that, a good example of that is when I discussed a little earlier, and this is probably more pertinent to this topic, is when he would get verbally or physically abusive, it would be my fault. I caused him to do something to react that way to me.
And how about this one, promiscuous sexual behavior? Well, we went through that, so we certainly saw that that was true. Lack of realistic life plan, tends to move around a lot or makes all-encompassing promises for the future. Poor work ethic, but exploits others effectively.
Mine always wanted to move away and change his name. He
mm-hmm.
always wanted to move to a place where no one would know who he is, and just have a whole new identity.
And did you move around much while you were married?
We did some, but only for job opportunities, not just randomly. But he always wanted to move away to California or go far, far away where no one knew him and just change his name.
Mm-hmm. How about yours?
And actually,
did yours move around much, Teresa, or no?
We only moved for job opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
But he wanted to move away where no one would know him. And he actually does have a fake identity that he goes by.
Great.
I don't share that on the radio. But.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, so those are some of the characteristics of the sociopath. And if any of our listeners are interested in getting the full report, please feel free to contact me at bonkaye@aol.com. And I'll be happy to send you that report, because I think that when people start living a lie, and that's what we were talking about, Teresa, earlier, when they're living a lie on a daily basis, that lying just becomes inherent in their personality. And, you know, because they're trying to cover who they are, you know, you don't even know where one lie starts and the next lie ends, you know, when your whole life becomes one big lie. So that's how I think, you know, they develop this. I don't know if they're born with it but they certainly develop it once they start living their own life and believing their own lies on top of it. And I think
maybe it's somewhat of a survival skill for themselves.
I think so. I think that's why, you know, I get a lot of letters each week from women who tell me that, you know, their husbands claim they're bisexual. In other words, they're out there having sex with men, not with their wives, but that makes them bisexual. And
mine always the term bicurious.
Bicurious, bisexual, asexual, trisexual, whatever it is. The point is that they just can't say that word gay. And in their minds, you know, and they're lying to themselves because they don't have to accept the fact that that's what they are. So I think that's where the big lie starts. And we wanted to get back to what our topic was earlier before you got on with us, Teresa. We were talking about when children are growing up and they come from an abusive situation to start with, that a lot of times they just keep moving into the next situation in their marriages. And did you find that to be true?
I definitely did. My parents didn't get along at all. My dad was an alcoholic, and he was a very violent alcoholic. And so there was never any peace or harmony in our home. So I didn't really know what normal was. So when I argued with my husband, or we just didn't get along, or we're not, didn't have that closeness, it wasn't unusual to me because that's all I had ever known anyway. So I didn't know what normal was.
Let me ask you this. How old were you when you got married?
I was 23.
Okay, and were you still living at home at that point?
Yes.
So, in certain ways, do you feel like this was a way out of your home?
Yes. There was a point where I couldn't imagine how I could. There was a time when I had no idea how I would ever get out from under my parents, and there was so much screaming that I was actually suicidal because I couldn't wait until I was 18. I couldn't tolerate it for that much longer. So I was actually suicidal, and my mother had to take me to the emergency room one night for treatment. And the doctor made her leave the room, and he asked me what was going on. And so I shared some things with him, which I was never allowed to share, but I did share some things. And I remember him telling my mother, "I don't know what's going on at home, but whatever it is, you better get it fixed." We were never allowed to share in church. You know, at church, they have an invitation. You're supposed to come up and share. My dad used to say, "If you say anything, I'll beat the H out of you when you get home." We were not allowed to tell anyone. I remember telling my aunt, who I loved and trusted, and she told my mom that I had told her how much arguing and how much drinking was going on at home. And then my mom told me I was never to tell my aunt anything. There was no one. I remember even going to social services as a child and trying to get help. And my dad was so mean, they were afraid to get involved. No one would get involved. There was no one who would reach out to help us.
So you must have felt very helpless at that point.
I did. I did. And I actually, finally there was a breaking point, and I actually, when I was, I don't remember if I was 16 or 17, I had myself declared emancipated, which is very, very hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the court declared me emancipated. But I had no place to go, so I still had to go back home.
Mm-hmm.
No one would help us because my dad was so mean. They were afraid to get involved because they were afraid he would kill them.
Wow.
Or burn their house down. I remember the night before I went to court to be emancipated, I actually stayed with the Sunday, I would reach out to my Sunday school teachers, but I actually ran away from home and went to a Sunday school teacher's house. And I laid at that night and listened to them talk, that they were afraid that he would find out where I was and he would burn their house down. He was just really mean. So, you know, living with the gay husband issue wasn't any worse than living at home. Actually, it wasn't even as bad.
How did you meet your husband?
Because at least he wasn't threatening to kill me.
How did you meet your husband?
We were in high school together, and then I got attracted to him in college.
Were you going out with him before college, or?
No. I remember we were more acquaintances in high school, and then when I went to college, you know, we just started palling around together. We had a class together. We'd go study together and run around together. And then you know, eventually a relationship developed.
Now, did he know about your home life?
Probably he did. Only for me talking about it.
Right.
By the time I started dating, my dad had passed away.
Your dad passed away?
Yeah, my father had passed away when
right,
I was...
Right, but I mean, had he heard you talking about it, you know, over those, you know, that period of time?
Because
what we were saying is that, you know, these guys who are predators, they're looking for women who they know come from these kinds of backgrounds because they know that, you know, they're willing to tolerate a lot more than other women.
Mm-hmm, very high tolerance level. And
so he may have just sensed that within you. That
I think he probably sensed it more than me talking about it.
Let me ask you this. What kind of family life did he come from?
His parents were married for a long time. There are several kids in his family, several siblings. And his mother, his dad was a farmer. His mother nagged a lot. I loved her. She was good to me, but she would nag and nag nonstop. And that's where, and that was the personality that he has. Once I got him out of the house and we were not together anymore, our daughter lived with him, and he did that to her. He would just nag and nag and nag.
Mm-hmm. And was his father, was it an affectionate couple, would you say, or?
No, not really.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Because we were saying how, you know, relationships really impact your future relationship when you're growing up with that. And you certainly didn't come from a relationship where there was love, tenderness, or caring. I was just going to say, it seems like he didn't come from one where there was a lot of that around either.
Right. And I wasn't allowed to reach out for help as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And as an adult, I was hesitant to reach out for help. You know, there was nothing I wanted more than just to be married and have a home and have kids and be a mom and, you know, be involved in church. And I had this perfect little scenario world that I lived in, it appeared to be. And I didn't want anyone to know that wasn't true.
How about when you were dating him? Did you notice that he had any characteristics that you weren't happy with?
He drank a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, well, he's a good man. If I could just get him to stop drinking,
mm-hmm.
he could be a good husband. And
mm-hmm.
So early on, I didn't realize that he drank. And then one day we were in the car, and he threw an empty liquor bottle out the window. It probably was vodka that, you know, didn't have any odor to it. And then I realized I was with a man who was drunk, and he was driving me around. But I was used to a drunk man anyway. So
right,
at least
so
he wasn't cheating on me.
It was that unusual, right?
No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't.
Because
it was the norm that I was used to.
Exactly. And let me just ask you, with your parents, now, was your father abusive to your mother also?
Yes, he was.
And was he physically abusive to her?
He was, to some degree, not a whole lot, but to some degree he was. He was mostly yelling, and he would, if he didn't get his way, he'd leave and get drunk, and then he'd come home and all hell would break loose. There would be screaming and, it was just screaming all the time. All the time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, did he make your mother cry a lot?
She would get angry and just scream back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and another thing, Bonnie, my dad used to come home drunk, and he would actually try to kill our family. He would come home with a loaded gun. And I remember as a teenager wrestling this loaded gun away from this man who was drunk.
Mm-hmm.
So there was nothing in my marriage that got... Well, in the end it did, because he was making murder-suicide threats towards me. And that's when I stopped myself and thought, you know, as a child I didn't really have a choice. I was stuck, but as an adult, I had a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I stopped and started realizing that I needed to get out of the relationship.
But that took a while, right?
It did.
Because I think we all feel that in these marriages that we have to try harder, that we can change these guys, that if we show them enough love, their behaviors will change. You know, because we just feel we have to keep hanging in there, trying to make something work that just can't work.
Right.
Until you come to the point where you realize that, you know, this isn't ever going to work. And what effect do you think it had on your children?
I definitely can see the pattern repeating. Our daughter lived with him initially when we first divorced.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw her tolerating his being drunk and his screaming and his slamming doors and his behavior. And I thought, wow, she learned what she lived with.
Mm-hmm.
And I see her choosing men who are not good to her, who don't respect her. So, you know, she was tolerant. She has been tolerant with her dad, and now she's making the same choices with the men. So the pattern, and when she shares things with me about what's going on with her relationships, I, you know, don't yell at her or scold her. I just talk to her and tell her,
right,
you know, this is what you lived with, and that's why you're doing that. That's why you're living, why you're making these choices. And I ask her, do you want to be treated this way forever? Don't you want someone who's going to love you and respect you and try to help her think her way through it?
And what's her response?
I can see her going deep into thought, and she'll acknowledge that I'm right.
Mm-hmm.
She, on a conscious level, she knows that I'm right.
Mm-hmm.
But she still is caught up in these emotional relationships that she can't seem to break herself out of.
And do you think that, you know, she looks for these kinds of relationships? Or do you think they look for her?
She seems to want to rescue the underdog. So if she finds a man who seems to be down and out,
mm-hmm.
She thinks she can rescue him like I thought I could rescue my gay husband in our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So I think probably they can feel the vibes from her, and she thinks she can rescue. She thinks she can go in and fix it all.
And I think that's very common. You know, like I say, we tried to do it for years. And
mm-hmm.
So maybe there's a part of that that goes into their relationships with the children.
Mm-hmm.
But going back to your family and growing up in such a, you know, horrible, horrific type of family situation, when you met your husband, you were living back home at that point, right?
Right.
And did you feel, well, you know, if you were in a happier situation, would you have still had a marriage with him? Or do you think you settled?
If I had been in a happier situation and a healthier situation, I think my parents would have seen that I was attracted to a man who was an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with some strong parental guidance, they could have coached me out of that. You know, my mom didn't like him, and she would, when I would go home, she would greet me at the door, and she would walk behind me every step I took through the house, and she would just yell and bitch and nag. So then there was no peace with me if I was around her, because she would just go into that hysterical, you know, frenzy that she and my dad previously had gone into. Then she started focusing that on that dysfunctional behavior on me.
Uh-huh.
So I couldn't even think. Not only did she not, you know, have a sit-down, intelligent conversation with me, just someone screaming at you, you just can't think through. You just can't think your way through.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that, Misty?
Wow. Well, I like the comment that she said. I think it's very interesting how Teresa, you said if you had been involved in a healthy relationship like with your parents, how that they would help notice things that you were going into. And I think that's very eye-opening for a lot of parents out there. You know, number one, make sure you are involved in healthy relationships. Obviously, it sounds like, and my heart goes out to you, it sounds like you were in such a broken, you know, you got to experience such a broken relationship growing up. I can see where that maybe your gay ex-husband had some qualities you were attracted to, and, you know, because maybe it was calmer or whatever. I'm not for sure. But then, you know, you get into that relationship, and then, but I also think this is wonderful. This is where I think the human spirit is resilient. Even though it, you know, it may have took you longer than you realized to get out of the relationship with your gay ex-husband, I think it's beautiful how that you said that once you notice that you, as an adult, had choices, you could leave. I think that's wonderful. I think that shows all of us that, you know, and gives all of us strength. Once you realize that, you can go.
Well,
you don't have to put up with it.
Well, last time Teresa was with us, and unfortunately, we got cut off at the end of that conversation, and we really didn't have a chance to discuss it. But, Teresa, you said the most profound words that anyone has ever said on this subject, as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, I've had a couple of epiphanies over the last 25 years of doing this, and yours was one of them for sure when you stated your words. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that to our listeners, because I think they need to hear this message. It's so important.
Okay. I was standing in the kitchen, and I remember just thinking through, you know, the different chapter stages of my life and thinking about when I, you know, how I was mistreated as a child and didn't have that healthy, strong family background and was suicidal, and no one would help me to get out. Everyone was afraid to do anything. And I was just thinking about what a victim I was, and I was very much a victim. And then thinking into my adulthood, the different things I'd gone through with my gay husband, I was married at the time, and thinking I was a victim, and then I thought, well, no, I'm really not a victim. Now that I know that he's gay, now that I know that I'm being mistreated, now I'm a volunteer. As a child, I was a victim, and when I didn't realize what I was dealing with in my marriage, I was a victim. But once all those things fell into place, then I realized that I was a volunteer, and I needed to do something to get out of it.
And I think those are the most profound words, you know, that a lot of times we say that we're victims, and we are victims. You know, we go in unsuspectingly to these marriages, you know, going in there with all the hopes and dreams that every other woman has about having a family life. As you were saying, when you got married, this was your dream, having children, having a loving marriage, having someone you can grow old with, someone who's your best friend, and, you know, it falls apart and it shatters. And we all feel, you know, when we find out the news or we suspect the news, that we're victims. But for those women, you know, who continue to stay there, you can't consider yourself a victim anymore, as Teresa said, and they are now a volunteer and allowing it to happen. And that's when you have to really make that decision. You know what? I'm not going to volunteer for this duty anymore. It's time for me to get out of it.
And parents need to pay attention to what's going on with children. You know, children show what they're thinking and feeling through their play. And I remember as a child pretending that my doll was crying. I don't remember what was wrong with the doll, but I just remember, you know, making the crying sound that my doll was crying. And my dad called me over to him, and I walked over to him, and he picked me up and just beat the crap out of me and said, "There, now I'll give you something to cry about." So even as a child, I really learned to suppress my emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very much a grown-up adult now, and I still find myself, you know, now I can look back in my childhood and think of, and see it from an adult perspective. So I kind of parent the child in me at times, and if I don't let my emotions out, or I try to help myself. Another thing I have is that I will have a little something go wrong, and my body just goes into panic mode, and yeah, something's not right, you know, whether it's at work or something at home isn't going right. I just, my body reacts in that state of emergency, the same emergency that it was in when my dad was home with a loaded gun. now the issues I have are not that big. So just trying to teach my body to, and my mind, that it's okay to be upset, but a little bit upset, don't panic. It's not a panic situation.
Well, I think that's wonderful that, you know, you're that strong. That, and I know it hasn't been an easy journey for you because I've been with you through some of your struggles. And yet, you know, you keep so focused and you're so determined to make sure that, you know, you can have the best things in life that, you know, you didn't have all these years. And I think that's such a problem that when you grow up and you live in such an abusive situation and then you move into a relationship that's an abusive relationship, you don't even know what to expect, what is normal. Did you find yourself, you know, questioning that much?
Yes, absolutely. I remember when my husband at the time and I went to counseling and sharing with our pastor different things, and he said, "Wow, no wonder you can't get along. You've never had a normal relationship. You don't know what normal would look like if you had it." So...
so I guess that's an adjustment in itself to try to figure out what is normal. One of the things we wanted to ask you also was that moving ahead, you know, and I know that it's your hope one day to find someone who could be your soulmate or someone who you can have a relationship with, and you've really worked hard coming to terms with who you are, you know, and appreciating you for who you are.
Mm-hmm.
But what kinds of things would you do differently in your future relationship than you've done in the past?
What would I do differently? When I definitely would not get involved with a man who drinks a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely would not let a man stand and yell at me again.
Mm-hmm.
I try to be... it's been very important to me to prove to myself that I can support myself by myself. And I think... you know, when you're young in a marriage and you have little children, men, gay or not, seem to think that you're vulnerable and that you have to put up with a lot of bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So
because you're economically dependent on someone.
Right. So, you know, it's not easy trying to make ends meet. Any house you live in is a two-income neighborhood anymore. So I'm very tight with my budget. I'm separating my wants from my needs and just make do with what I have as much as I can.
You feel that your life has changed in a really positive way since you ended the marriage?
Definitely, yes. I remember when he first left, when we first got him out of the house, my gay husband at the time, it was 2 or 3 days later, our son stayed in his room a lot, and 2 or 3 days later, with the door shut, 2 or 3 days after his dad was gone, he came downstairs, and he just said, "Wow, Mom, the house is so quiet and so calm." And he started hanging out with me in the front room instead of keeping himself locked up in his bedroom all the time.
And how old was he at that time?
He, let me think, that was 2006. So it was 4 years ago, so he was 15. He was 15 at the time. You know, that's a very volatile time for teenagers because that's when they hit that fork in the road. They're going to take one path and be a good kid, or they're going to take the other path, and they're going to be drinking and smoking pot and making bad choices and hanging with wrong kids. And he's been a really good kid. He saw what all the drinking and all the pot did, because his dad always smoked pot, for the last few years.
Has he ever come to you and said to you, why did you stay so long?
No, he hasn't, but he told me that he was glad that I made it stop.
And how about your daughter? Was your daughter upset when you split up?
She was, because she felt sorry for her dad, because her dad whined and complained and nagged and took out on her what he had previously taken out on me.
Uh-huh.
And so she came and said, "Mom, why did you do this? You don't even act like you're upset about it." And so I told her why. Because she was so bold to challenge me and ask me so abruptly why I did it, she was 18 at the time, and so I told her. I told her everything about everything. And she agreed that I did the right thing. At one point, my husband and I separated, and then I felt sorry for him and let him come back. We were separated for about almost 2 months, and I let him come back home.
Uh-huh.
And both of the kids were really angry at me. They said, "Why did you let him come back home?" Because they knew how abused I was.
Uh-huh.
And even though our daughter was taking his side, she uh-huh. still knew right from wrong. And she said, "Why did you let him come back home? Why did you do that?" And it took me, December, January, February. It took me 4 months to get him back out of the house.
Wow.
I got him back out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And, no matter how much I struggle financially or no matter what things break at home, and, you know, there's some things it just takes a man to fix. I don't have the strength. I might have some know-how. I have a leaky toilet upstairs right now. I'm not strong enough to fix it, but I know how to fix it. I'm just not using it. I'm just using a different bathroom. I'm just grateful to not have someone in the house yelling at me and mistreating me. So, you know, you just learn to deal with other things.
Right, and I think that that's, you know, having peace of mind is the most important thing of all. You know, knowing you can go to bed at night and wake up in the morning when you want to wake up. And
right.
not feel you have to get this together and that together for them. You know, and we have the crack of dawn for doing stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, that was a big adjustment, but you made it. And I'd like for you to talk for a moment about the value of support, because a lot of women who listen to this program don't realize that you can get tremendous support from other women who are part of our support network. And that can really make a whole difference in your attitude and how you feel, because I think that so many of our women feel so isolated and alone when they go through this. Like they're the only ones who are going through it, or they feel a sense of shame and embarrassment. Did you feel that sense of shame and embarrassment at all, Teresa?
I did. I did for a long time. I was so afraid to reach out. That was before the times of when you had your chat group and you had a newsletter. I just thought I was all alone in the world. I was so alone.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know where to turn or who to talk to. And having women that you haven't met before who are sharing the same thing, or finding someone in the community, that someone at work or someone at church who
uh-huh.
secretly is married to a gay man also, and being able to help each other and lift each other up, it is just very, it's very powerful. It really is very powerful. And, you know, I have been alone now for 4 years. My divorce has been final for 2.5 years. So I'm not in the middle of that lifestyle anymore. But I feel like it's my responsibility to give back.
Mm-hmm.
And so I still stay in the chat group, and I still help women that I find that are married to gay men. I still feel like it's my way of giving back, much like someone who's lost a child or women who've been raped, and they go into that ministry and help other women who have lost a child or been raped. I feel like this is somewhat of a ministry for me.
It's really incredible, you know, that you're doing that. You know, and like I say, you're always willing to share your experiences, and I think people learn so much from this. I mean, that's my personal opinion, but by hearing, you know, the things that you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to say, Teresa, because I do know you pretty well, that Teresa to me is truly a miracle, because she's really come from the most adverse, you know, situations and pulled her life together and, you know, takes care of all of her own needs. She doesn't need anybody to help give her support. You know, she's totally independent, which I think is just incredible that you've come this far, where you were so codependent on these destructive relations for so long.
Mm-hmm.
But it was hard work, right?
It was very hard work.
I think
it
the
was
people
very
think
hard
you
work.
Just make a decision and, okay, I'll leave tomorrow and that's it. It took a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. It did. It took a lot of work. I remember when I realized I was a volunteer instead of a victim, and then I remember trying to divorce myself emotionally. I was in a situation where it just wasn't the right time and place for me to get out, so I focused on divorcing emotionally and planning financially.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I remember him wanting us to take out a second mortgage on our house. I remember my credit score was a little higher than his, and he wanted me to, he had a credit card, and his interest got bumped up a little bit, and he wanted me to get a credit card to absorb that credit so we could have the lower interest. And I remember just having to say no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just, you have to say no. Don't let someone get you trapped.
I'm sure he wasn't very happy about it, right?
No, he was yelling and demanding, and I just remember telling him no.
Let me ask you this. Do you see any of his characteristics in your own children?
Do I see his... Well, the two kids are half of him, so I see my son... Our son, I can see in his... I don't know how to answer that, Bonnie.
Uh-huh.
Before we separated, I knew that I was going to not stay with him, and I knew that the kids were going to mind me. They were going to do what I was going to be the boss. And I remember being very strong and very firm and taking the tough love approach with both of those kids, because they might not have to mind him because he was willing to drink and do bad things with our daughter.
Uh-huh.
But she wasn't going to do that with me or around me. And so I took a tough love approach. So she took that path of drinking and acting up like her father. She's a little older now, and she's making better decisions. Our son, he kind of is the opposite. Instead of having to make his own mistakes, he saw what the drinking and what the bad behavior did, and so he's just the opposite. And he doesn't want to be out drinking and smoking pot, and he's very good to me. He's very polite and very respectful to me. When he's not, I tell him, you know what, if I wanted a man to mistreat me, I'd invite your dad to come back home and live with me, but I don't want someone to mistreat me, so you're not going to act that way. So you can
mm-hmm.
stop it right now. So I make sure that I'm very strong and very firm in setting the boundaries so the kids don't play his part in the relationship with me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me. How about you, Misty?
I think that's great. It sounds like you just described some wonderful parenting boundaries. Good for you. And Teresa, I have a question for you. I admire
mm-hmm.
you so much because I think your human spirit is just so strong and so resilient, especially knowing your past and you talking to us on this show. You know, you said something that I really liked, and this is often what I tell the women I work with. You know, you have to really define a new sense of normalcy. And with you, you really didn't have a sense of normalcy growing up, and then you got into a relationship that wasn't, you know, what you expected, and it was... you know, married to a gay man that you thought was straight. So during this process, what could you tell our listeners, some tips that helped you to define a healthy and a new normalcy? What helped you do that?
What helped me do that?
Mm-hmm.
When I made up my mind that I didn't want to be a volunteer anymore and that I was going to put a stop to it, gosh, Misty, that's a tough question. I don't know how I would answer that. I just know that I wanted some peace and some quiet. I didn't want my kids to repeat the pattern of what I did, of being tolerant of someone mistreating them. And so I just started thinking of what I didn't like about the relationship and turn it around into things that were more acceptable to me.
I think it's great.
I
do that with a lot of the women I work with. I tell them to write down everything they don't like about the relationship that they've had in the past.
Uh-huh.
And then from that, oftentimes you
mm-hmm.
can set a new set of normalcy of what you wish to have.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking for some advice that Teresa could give to our listeners who are out there. As far as putting your own life on track, what do you suggest to women when they're getting out of marriages? I mean, do you think they should run out and start dating right away again?
No. Let me back up just a little bit, though. When I was right in the middle of my husband, my gay husband, mistreating me at home, this is how much I can put up when I was in the middle of being with death threats and sleeping on the couch by the front door because I was scared, and I remember telling my manager at work, calling him aside one day and telling him what I was going through at home, and he had absolutely no idea. He couldn't tell it in my personality. He couldn't tell it in the quality of work that I was doing. He had no idea that there was anything going on at home. But I learned as a child to not how to hide it. And anyway.
So,
okay, what was your question again, Bonnie? I'm sorry.
Now, if you would have some advice, you know, to women about building up their lives, you know, as they're moving on. You know, that to take the time before you run out dating again.
Mm-hmm.
That you shouldn't just jump into a relationship, that you really need to work on yourself first.
Right. I tried to date a little bit when my divorce was very, very first final. And I think that I was probably giving off radars and I was needy. And I can just imagine what kind of radar signals I was shooting off. And so I backed off and thought, I just need to get focused with myself. I need to get my home settled. I need to get my finances in order. I needed to parent. It was very important to me to make sure my kids stayed on the right path. It was very important to me that I did a good job at work because I have to have a job to be able to support myself. So I focused on my parenting, my job, putting my house together.
Right. All things, and every step that you took didn't make you feel better about yourself.
Yes.
Yeah,
it does.
That it gave you the confidence that you could make it on your own.
Yes. It does. And it does.
Because
very
I think that
so.
That's the most important part after a marriage is over, that if you're going to get into another relationship again, in order not to make the same mistakes over and over, is to get to know what it was within you that put you in that position to start with.
I've been playing around with the dating sites recently, and, you know, the profiles come up. Do they smoke? Yes or no. And then do they drink? And sometimes they'll say several times a week. I just automatically get rid of those. Because I've already been there and done that.
Anything less than what you would want.
Right.
And I think that you can afford to be choosy.
I focus on my kids. I focus on myself. I focus on my friendships. I focus on reaching back out and helping other women to get out of the mess. I just am not in a... I would like to meet someone. I get lonesome, but I just haven't made that a priority. I mean, it's more important that I just get healthy. I'd rather be alone than be in an unhealthy relationship.
Right. In
so
fact,
I'm just taking my time.
I mentioned that today to this woman who I was, you know, having lunch with, that, you know, you could feel very lonely, but you can feel just as lonely, if not more so, more lonely if you're with the wrong person.
Mm-hmm.
Look how many bad relationships stay together, and women never feel fulfilled. You know, it thwarts them from, instead of inspiring them to do things, it thwarts them from whatever, you know, creativity they may have. Because you always feel like you're the keeper of, you know, the prison there, that you're afraid to go out. I know that was my case. I was always afraid to leave my house because I was afraid if I walked out to do anything, go back to school or, you know, do anything with my friends, that somebody would be in my house that I didn't want there. So I felt like I was protecting my house. You know, I really felt like I had some control, which really I had none. Because when these guys want to go out and do stuff, they don't need to be in your house. But, you know, you try to hold all ends together and you stop yourself from really becoming the person that you want to be. And did you find that happening to you?
Not being the person that I want to be?
Yeah, not being able to do anything because you're just thwarted in that whole relationship.
Yes, I'm just now starting to be me. I've been alone for 4 years. I've been divorced for 2.5, and I'm just now starting to get more in touch with myself. With, you know, what I found a letter. I was cleaning out a box in the garage I found this letter that I wrote 21 years ago saying that I wanted to, wanted to focus on being home and wanted to just the things that were important to me. And I just thought, wow, I was a smart little thing 21 years ago, so why don't I just focus on that now?
And I think you never had a chance to develop that because you were in such a, you know, distorted type of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if you wanted to, like, you know, we keep saying about the circle of crazy, when you're sitting and dancing in it, you know, that becomes your sense of reality, and reality just goes out the door.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to even think clearly when you're in the middle of the mess, in the circle of crazy. You can't even make, it's hard to make decisions. It's hard to know if you're, what you think is real, if it's really real, or if it's, or you just think you're going crazy in the middle of it. I remember calling a counseling place. This is kind of changing the subject a little bit, but I remember calling for counseling, and the lady who answered the phone, this would have been about six or 7 years ago, the lady who answered the phone started laughing. She just thought it was so funny, and she was a stranger to me. I didn't know her. She didn't know me. We were on the phone, and I was so embarrassed. I just hung up. It's so hard to know how to reach out for help.
Mm-hmm. And that's another problem also, Teresa, that I think Missy would confirm also. There are a lot of people out there who are practicing what they call therapy or counseling that are totally not qualified to be doing so.
Yes.
And they certainly don't understand a lot of problems, and especially our problem. And for somebody to laugh at that, and I'll never forget when I was having problems early in my marriage, you know, I secretly went and I called a marriage counselor, and I said, I really need help in my marriage. You know, I'm really having problems. And she said to me, well, the only way I can help you is if both you and your husband come in. And I said, well, my husband doesn't want to come in. He refuses to come in. He doesn't want to discuss this problem. And she said to me, well, if he doesn't want to talk about it, then, you know, there's nothing we can do because marriage counseling, you need both people. And, I mean, I certainly understand that that's the party line, you know, now that I am a counselor. But what she should have said to me is that, look, you know, marriage counseling's not really the right thing right now if he doesn't want to go, but let's get some counseling for you so you can try to figure out what the problem is. But, you know, she didn't take that step either, so I just hung up also feeling defeated, feeling I'm never going to get the help that I really need. So I would like to encourage women that if you go, you know, to counselors and you feel that you're not getting what you need out of it, end that relationship, you know, because a lot of counselors really are not, you know, adequate counselors, and start looking for another one. You know, I think a lot of women need counseling, and they need support, and they need help. And, of course, I always would like to encourage women to come to our support group that we have online, because we have people like Teresa who are with us, who have the experience, who are willing to give of themselves. And, of course, Misty and I are there twice a week also. You know, trying to get people through the rough spots. We have some other wonderful women who we've become sort of like a family together, you know, helping each other through whatever rough spots there are. And we can give really great advice, and we can really, you know, help you with some of the issues that are coming up. And all you have to do is write to me at bondk@aol.com, and I'll be more than happy to, you know, hook you up for a support chat, because sometimes just having that human touch, even if it's on a computer, that somebody understands exactly what you're feeling, or that you're not alone. And I mean, I know this radio show is important to, you know, so many people because they don't feel as isolated or alone. But sometimes actually seeing it or being part of it or hearing it, you know, and especially, you know, Misty has her sessions for, you know, healing, that, you know, you feel that, you know, there's hope out there, where I know that all of us, well, three of us here who are on this, you know, show right now, that we really felt isolated and alone when we were going through all of this until we were able to find help. Wouldn't you say so?
And I would say you have to be very careful with therapists because there are so few people who know a whole lot about all the gay issues that you can go to a bad therapist and become very, very confused. I remember going to a man. I actually went for our daughter, and she refused to talk to this man. And then I ended up talking to him a little bit. Then he wanted to talk to my husband and I. And so we we went together, and I brought up some of the promiscuous sexual activity, and this counselor threw his arm out, pointed his finger at me, and yelled at me and said, "You are trying to attack this man's character." And I remember saying, "No, I'm just trying to get a grip on understanding that he's gay." And I remember getting up and leaving at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So you just have to be careful.
You do, because once again, so many people don't understand the dynamics here. And especially, I think, for both of you, you know, who can attest to the fact that you both come from Christian backgrounds and Christian upbringing, that a lot of times if you go to Christian types of counselors, they're very judgmental as far as giving you bad advice as far as staying in the marriage, because, you know, that might be their religious way of thinking without worrying about how it's affecting you or your family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not familiar with the situation, and they think that gay is a choice where you can pray gay away. And, you know, you just have to have faith, like, you know, if you love your husband enough, he won't have those feelings anymore, because they just don't understand the situation.
Mm-hmm. I've been there and done that one, too. So.
Right. And, Misty, you have your sessions coming up, right?
Yes, I do. And I want to throw a little bit of thing in there and about therapists, and I can certainly say this because I am one, so here's what I'm going to say. I tell
mm-hmm.
all my clients, because I do life coaching now, but even when I was doing therapy, I tell all my clients, when you go to seek therapy or counseling, try to really not look at it emotionally and look at it in terms of being a consumer. Look at it as like buying a pair of shoes. When you buy a pair of shoes, it's got to fit right. If the fit's not right, don't buy it. So you really have to look at it. You are the consumer and you're paying. I have enough sense to know my services are not for everyone. But, you know, for straight spouses, usually I'm a really good fit in that niche. So really just look at it as being the consumer. And the other little thing about the thing coming up, I do have a event coming up this April, and it's a workshop, which is a four-week workshop, on grief. And I did a Saturday seminar on this last month, and it got such really rave reviews and requests, I decided to turn it into a four-week event. So if you want to know anything about that, you can email me or Bonnie. You can email me at Misty Lynn Hall, MistyLynnHall, at AOL.com, and there's spaces to join. It will start... Let me get the information. It starts April the 19th. So if you want any information on that, just let me or Bonnie know, and thank you.
And I do want to mention that next week, this coming week, my newsletter will be out, my April newsletter, and you can read about Misty's upcoming sessions in that. And I also wanted to mention for our show next week, it's going to be focused on what part of the issue of the newsletter is about. I'm going to have another special guest on, Wendy, who's done a beautiful job on her recovery map and the different phases that she's gone through, and she's really articulated it so beautifully. And if anyone listening is not receiving my newsletter and would like to be on my newsletter list, just drop me a note at bonk@aol.com or go to my website at www.gayhusbandswithans.com. And write to me there and just say you'd like to be getting the newsletter, because you'll be reading about this recovery map that we're going to be talking about next time that we're on the show next Sunday night. So that'll be a really interesting show, because when Wendy discusses, you know, her journey and what she's gone through all the different phases, I think all of you will really have a roadmap of where to look. So at this point, time for us to say goodnight. Teresa, I can't thank you enough. You know, you're just such a wonderful guest that we hope will keep coming back and back again, because you shed such wonderful insight to us in your honesty and openness and candor that I think a lot of women really will learn a lot from the words that you gave us tonight. So
thank you
so much for joining us. And Misty, I hope you have a wonderful week, and I hope that everybody will be listening next Sunday to our show of Straight Wives. So, good night, everybody.
Good night, and thank you, Teresa. Okay,
good night,
friends.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.